The sports world is still buzzing about Caster Semenya, the South African runner and gold medalist who reignited a debate about gender last week when the International Association of Athletics Federations ruled that if she wants to continue competing, she must take drugs that suppress the high levels of testosterone her body naturally produces. Now, reports about Semenya often conclude that because she has more testosterone than the average woman, she must be intersex. We want to be clear. Semenya herself has never said she is intersex, but intersex activists support her, and some people listening in on the debate have wondered, what does that even mean? We want to find out more. So a note, this conversation may be a little mature for some ears, lots of biology. Courtney Finlayson is a pediatric endocrinologist at the Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. Dr. Finlayson, you have many intersex patients. We know that that means, very simply, just to start, their genitalia may be different from how it's presumed it would be.
In essence, that's part of it, yes. Sex development is a biological term that's used to describe the process by which sex chromosomes, like X and Y chromosomes, gonadal tissue, which is usually ovarian or testicular, and internal and external genitalia form. And one of the most important things is to understand how the process usually occurs to understand how differences can happen. So it begins at conception, and most is completed by the end of the first trimester of pregnancy. And when babies are forming, all babies, boys and girls, start out exactly the same. They start out with generic gonadal tissue, which can become ovaries or testicles. And then once those form, ovaries or testicles make hormones that tell internal structures like the uterus in females or seminal vesicles in males, and external structures like the clitoris or the penis to become typically male or female. So there are hundreds, if not thousands, of little steps that have to occur exactly for development into what people typically expect for boys or girls. And any little change causes a difference in that process of sex development.
So an infant could have, for instance, a female genitalia, a vagina, but also testicles. I'm kind of making up that combination.
Yes, that is possible. So there, for example, there are conditions like something called complete androgen insensitivity syndrome, in which somebody has XY chromosomes, so typical for a boy, and they develop testicles, and the testicles make testosterone, but the body can't react to that testosterone. The receptor doesn't work. So it's almost as if no testosterone were ever made. And so people who have that condition may look completely female on the outside at birth.
And by the way, how many people are we talking about with this condition?
So it depends on exactly how you define it, but somewhere maybe between 1 in 2,000 to 1 in 5,000. So that means that these conditions are relatively rare, but they're common enough that you might easily know someone who has those traits. And people tend to keep this kind of information very private. And even among families, sometimes people may not know that a family member is affected.
Yeah. And there can be surgeries performed, you know, after a baby is born to, I'm making air quotes here, fix things.
So, yeah, you know, many individuals with these conditions have undergone some sort of surgery in the past and present. Some surgeries for infants or children who have these conditions is to remove gonadal, so ovarian or testicular tissue that has a risk of cancer. And in the past, it was recommended to remove that tissue as soon as the condition was diagnosed to avoid having it become cancerous, and because it was thought that that tissue would not make hormones or have any fertility potential. And the approach is evolving as we learn more about cancer risk and how that varies among different conditions. So sometimes the risk is low in early childhood and then rises in later adolescence or adulthood. And there might be some hormone function. So that removal of that tissue in childhood may not be essential or desirable. It may be reasonable sometimes to wait until an individual is older and can participate in that decision making. But I've also taken care of pediatric patients who have developed cancer. So as medical professionals in that situation, our duty is to present that information to patients and families, and they often agonize over those decisions, and ultimately some place greater value on potential gonadal function and others on avoiding cancer risk. The even more controversial is genitoplasty or surgery to change the external genitalia, and that may be for function or for appearance. And in the past, that was usually performed. And then particularly in the 90s, individuals with intersex traits began to speak out about their experiences. And some of them were very angry about the surgery that had been performed. You know, they may have had undesirable effects in terms of their future sexual function, or maybe they had a surgery that was done to make them appear more female, but they later identified as male. And so that's led to some changes, including increased discussion with parents about if and when genitoplasty should be performed, and changes in the surgical techniques with more effort to spare sexual function.
Well, and this brings us to a bill that was introduced in California in January that would consider intersex surgery performed on minors to be the equivalent of genital mutilation. This is after activists came forward to say just what you said.
Right. So I think the discussion about if and when genitoplasty should be performed is very important, and it's a necessary discussion. But I think equating it to genital mutilation loses the complexity of the dilemma and may cause harm. You know, genital mutilation legislation was created to address concerns about ritual circumcision, and this is different. But as you said, the current legislative controversy essentially lies in whether these surgeries should be allowed in infancy and childhood, when a parent is making a decision for a child, or whether any genital surgery should be prohibited until the individual can consent to their own procedure.
Well, what do you think, having worked in this field? I mean, it sounds as if there are pros and cons on both sides. There are people who've had this surgery who, you know, maybe are grateful for it, that they didn't have to go through a childhood of, you know, maybe bullying and confusion. And we're definitely hearing from activists who are saying they chose wrong, you know,
right.
And yeah, I'm not who they thought I was. And now I live with genitalia that doesn't belong, that I don't feel belongs to me.
So I've spent a great deal of time thinking about this issue and discussing it with intersex advocates and with medical and surgical and mental health providers. And in some situations, I think delaying decisions about genital surgery may be the best option. But I'm not convinced that it's always the right decision, and that's where I think this becomes really complicated. So I'm concerned that not doing surgery is not a neutral decision. So individuals may be forced to live with a body that does not match their gender identity. And we don't know the implications of this in intersex individuals. But we do know in transgender minors, and I also take care of that population, we know that gender dysphoria can lead to self-harm and depression and anxiety. And that in those situations, typically the only thing that is useful is to treat with gender-affirming hormones, or for those individuals to undergo surgery. And so simply trading in the intersex population, simply trading always do surgery for never do surgery may not be the ideal solution. And I worry that in the effort to help some children, a surgical ban may hurt others.
We hear you on that, but what is a solution then if these infants, is there any other way to tell what an intersex newborn is meant to be?
No.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's important to realize that in any child who's born, you know, we don't actually know whether they're going to identify as male or female when they grow up. Only the child can tell us that as they grow up. And so my thought is that in this period of time where we don't know some of these answers, I think that when we approach these issues with families, I think that any family considering surgery for their child has to be exposed to the arguments for and against surgery from advocates and activists. They have to have an open discussion with their medical and surgical and mental health team. They have to discuss or sort of assess the decision methodically. And I think ultimately the parents have to make the best decision that they can for their child. I feel like as a physician, it's my duty to inform patients about all of their options and families. And as a pediatrician, I've learned great respect for parents. So in most circumstances, they know their child best, and they will do their very best to make the best decision they can for their child.
Dr. Finlayson, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Robin.
Dr. Courtney Finlayson practices at the Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. By the way, that vote in California on a bill that would ban intersex surgery, equate it with genital mutilation, was delayed until next year.